This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. When Monika Johnson Hostler was young, kids were meant to be seen and not heard. But that's not the way she raises her own daughter. Monika decided that her life, especially since she has dedicated her life to the fight against sexual assault, that in her view the struggle is intimately connected to more subtle inequalities. Monika Johnson Hostler is executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also a member of the Wake County School Board, and our guest today on the State of Things. Monika, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
I want to talk about this generational divide that you found yourself having to jump, because when you first started working at a rape crisis center, your grandmother was really surprised.
She was. She, one, didn't think it was a career, so wasn't sure what this was I was talking about I was going to be doing for my for the rest of my career. And she said to me something I still say and hold dear, because it guides my work, is, people do not talk about being raped. You know that. So what is it that you're going to be doing? And that was her question to me, and I, of course, immediately had an answer, but I still ask myself that question over and over again to guide my work, to ensure that I'm actually doing it to hear what people are saying to me.
Well, it's interesting. What was your answer to her?
My immediate answer was, well, there wouldn't be an agency if people didn't need help, so of course somebody wants to talk about it. I was 21.
Did you have that sense that she had, that people wouldn't talk about, that victims of sexual assault wouldn't talk about it?
I did not. So while I was raised, you know, with the generation of children are raised to be seen, not heard, she had also really trained me to have a voice. I was raised by two very strong women, my maternal grandmother and my mother, who both had no boundaries on what they thought their role was, always were willing to give their two cents. So I think they forgot that they did raise me to believe that. So that's why my answer was as flippant as it was back to her, because I did believe that I was doing this work for a reason and people had something to say and I was willing to listen.
Of course, it's interesting that your grandmother would say that, given the fact that what you just said, someone who raised you to be outspoken, to not hold it in, they more than anybody would notice when somebody hasn't talked about something that important.
Absolutely. But I also recognize in that moment when she said to me, but knew it wasn't the right time to engage her, she was raised in a culture, and still, I mean, the African-American culture is still, people of color still struggle with sharing what is intimate in their family. And so that also guides my career, because most people think about rape or sexual assault as stranger danger. And what she was saying to me unspoken was, this is a family matter, and you don't air your dirty laundry.
You did have an experience, though, where a friend confided in you about her sexual assault.
I did. It's what actually started this journey for me. I had a college, she wasn't my roommate, but lived on my hall. We were close friends. And she came in, you know, wee hours of the morning, but everybody's up in college, to tell us about an experience she had had with someone she called her boyfriend, who was a football player. And when she described it, you already know who I am at this point. I was like, that's rape. And what are we? And I immediately went into, what are we going to do? How can we help you? And she knew in that moment that she wasn't going to report him to any campus officials. She knew she didn't want him to lose his scholarship, didn't want him to be kicked out of school. Which again speaks to me about women and what we take on at 18. She was taking on a space to protect someone who had hurt her and not thinking about herself first.
What did you say? What did you do? All this stuff's running through your
all
mind.
All that stuff was running through my mind. But I did listen. I did, you know, say, first I said, let me find out what you can do. And I did. I asked lots of questions, the counseling center, campus security. I asked a professor who I trusted. Everyone gave me the options, which was to report to the campus or local police, and she didn't want either of those. So then I went back to the counseling center, which she didn't want to go to, and that's when I found out what a rape crisis center was. It's because that's the option they gave me, that she could actually seek some outside confidential free services.
So, and what did she end up doing?
She actually did not finish school.
Wow.
She chose not to reach out to the rape crisis center. Mm. She, of course, did not want to talk about it. Like, I kept going back saying, here are more resources, here are more options. She said to me, just forget it, I have.
You didn't. You wrote a senior paper on it.
I did. I wrote a senior paper, and here we are. Oh, gosh, I wrote that paper in 95, and here we are now, 19 years later.
So when you wrote that paper, do you think you were on this path at all? Was this any part of your future plan?
No. I wrote the paper because it was still something that was unresolved for me personally. You know, I thought I was going to be a therapist. That's what I knew. Sexual assault still wasn't on my radar, that's what I'd be doing with what I thought was going to be a therapist. But I knew my senior year that was the one thing that wasn't resolved. I had no real answers. I lost contact with her. She pretty much severed ties with mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And so that still stuck with me. And so this paper was my resolution to myself.
What did you learn doing that paper?
Her experience was the experience of many. Mm. So when I interviewed the rape crisis volunteers and staff, I didn't tell them why, you know, what led me here other than it's a senior paper. I need to write this paper to graduate and I'm doing research. And countless number of stories, whether it was college students, whether it was young adults, whether it was young girls mm. and young boys, over and over again, the bulk of their clients did not report to law enforcement but sought services through their hotline. And so what I learned was, which I didn't have the language, you know, 4 years, 3 years prior to writing the paper, to say you can call them and you never have to disclose your name. Like, I use the word free, confidential, but what I didn't have is the capacity to explain that she could have gotten some services that probably could have changed her life.
So you use the word young several times. Then you get a job in Scotland County at the Rape Crisis Center there and realize that that doesn't apply to everybody, does it?
That's right. That's exactly what I realized. My first two clients was a 10-month-old baby boy and an 84-year-old woman, and both that, sexually assaulted in the first week of my work.
That surprised you.
It did. Yeah. One, I had a baby. I mean, for me, the surprise was this is the lifespan. Right. Like, I have a baby and a mother who clearly is my primary client, which I wasn't prepared for because I was trained that the parents are secondary. But I had a baby who wasn't verbal. And then I had this older adult woman whose house had been broken into by teens that she knew because it was a small community. And one of them raped her in the breaking and entering.
Where were you in your career when you that job at Scotland County? Had you been out? Did you graduate, or were you?
I graduated and took the job the same month, December of 1996.
Wow. So and it's interesting because your preparation, I mean, obviously now you're focused. By then you were focused, and still this is sort of the breadth of the
right.
scope
of my
this
work.
Problem was still not clear to you until that first time
on the job. I thought I was going to do community education in schools. Wow. About the topic.
Yeah, and you've got people on either end of the spectrum, or at least the age spectrum. And then you talked about, and I think something else you raised in those two cases, because the messaging in the 80s was that sexual assault was kind of associated with stranger danger. And now we're having to refocus that, aren't we?
Now I'm trying to refocus for myself at the same time that both of these cases, the perpetrator was not unfamiliar to the family or to the woman.
Is that a problem these days? Is it difficult to get to refocus our attention?
Sadly enough, I am still trying to refocus, not just in North Carolina, but nationwide. I mean, clearly with all the institutional sexual violence that we're talking about currently in this country, I think people are starting to at least hear that most perpetrators are known to the victim. However, if you ask a random person on the street, if you and I walked outside, people would still probably give us the definition of stranger danger.
Why do you think it's hard, so hard to convert that message or to get us to see that it's not always strange? In fact, it's rarely or
rarely,
less often.
Less often. Mm-hmm. I think it's a protective factor for most of us, especially women. I think as long as we believe that you can somehow control your environment enough to prevent rape, that it's a safety precaution. I also believe that you're able to say, well, it's not me, because if it's stranger, I'm going to tell my child, don't talk to strangers. I'm going to lock my doors. I'm going to carry my keys in my hand in the parking deck. Now, let's be clear. We've heard of all of those sexual assault cases in the media that happened because someone wasn't taking those precautionary measures. But we also know the bulk of the cases we hear, those precautionary measures would not have protected them from sexual violence.
This has to be tough for you as a mother and any parent mm-hmm. because, I mean, the part of this message is, okay, be afraid of strangers and be afraid of the people you know and are intimate with. I mean, how do you create that message and still allow for intimacy and appropriate mm-hmm. Kinds of contact?
So I'm a very open parent by nature of what I do and also what I've learned. You know, for me at 21, reconciling what my grandmother said and how I had been raised, clearly not the same thing, right? So that was my decision as a parent. I'd be very open with my daughter, and I have been. And I'm also very clear that she sets boundaries with people in her life. And so I strongly believe that if she understands how to engage in relationship with people and trust herself and know that she can trust me and her father, that if strangers strangers or people that she knows does anything that feels uncomfortable. And I always tell my friends, it doesn't mean you have to tell them the definition of sexual violence or child sexual abuse at five, but you do teach them about boundaries with people.
And this came up in an interesting way, the way your daughter has taken this on board, the idea that she has agency, that she has permission. You were at a, because you're also a member of the Wake County School Board, so mm-hmm. you hobnob with political folks, and up she
yes.
walks.
Yes, my daughter, I joke and say that we ran for school board and won as a family. And so she has to attend a lot of functions with her mother, and she's young and oftentimes the only child. And if there's other children, they're older. So she often interjects herself in conversations. And I'm having to learn that I've given her all of that leeway that often means you can't do anything in that moment except for let her engage in conversation. So even just, you know, a few weeks ago, we were at a 4th of July public event and I was talking to elected officials and she just walked up and was propped up on her umbrella just engaging us in conversation.
Celebrating independence way in the way.
And celebrating her own independence and independence of this country. That would have never been the case for me at 8 years old. I would have never felt comfortable or allowed to do that. And she does.
On the State of Things today, talking to Monika Johnson-Hostler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of the Wake County School Board. We will have more of this conversation just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Monika Johnson-Hostler, who is the executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of our state's largest school district, the Wake County School Board. You know, we talked about, and you hinted at this earlier when you talked about your friend who had reported her sexual assault, how much she took on as a woman, how much responsibility she took on. And you've looked at the research that suggests women, for instance, apologize more than men. Tell us about that. And again, for you as a mom, what that means for you.
Right. So most recently, there's been a lot of talk in magazines. Of course, I'm a social media junkie because it's quick reads. I love that. So there's a lot of conversation about the women apologizing. And what I did was just for a few hours of the day, paid attention to how many times I said, either in emails or verbally, I'm sorry, my apologies, my regards for not doing something. It was almost second nature. Now, this comes from a person who really is steeped in feminist beliefs and really believe that women have their own power and inherently we should be living our truths and our power. But yet I was also one of these people I was reading about who used and apologized a lot. So everything that I take in, I practice on my 8-year-old. Hopefully she won't ever hear the show that I'm practicing all of the things I believe on her. But I did. And for me, everyone in my work circle immediately was commenting on the article or engaging in dialogue around it because we do this work from a feminist perspective, a womanist perspective. And so what that did was really, for me, solidify what we've known to be true. And that is women mostly and children or vulnerable populations are less than. And so saying you are sorry or you apologize more than our male counterparts for me was just one more manifestation of how we felt like we needed to be apologizing or taking on something. Right. For something so simple as I didn't respond to your email in an hour. I started out with my apologies for the delay in my response. And it was like an hour later.
My apologies for your ADD, your impatience, and your critical. Yeah. But let me take you on a tangent on this, because this, I think, raises one of the most interesting and complex questions that we face. Any of us interested in social justice have to at some point face this. Women apologize more than men, which could mean men really need to apologize more, that there's nothing wrong with the apology, that it is inherently an act of humility, that if more of us engaged in, and yet you're right. When it becomes an act of sort of abject subjugation, when it means that we are less than, we have to raise it to critical attention.
That's
and
right.
Become aware of it. How do we sort? What do we do with that? That it would be better if all of us made this, and yet we have to become conscious of the fact that because only women do it or people who are in those lesser social situations are reinforcing the wrong message.
It's the same conversation, to your point, that most of us in the social justice movement struggle with right around any dialogue like this is it's contextually, yes, it's humane and we all should be apologizing. However, given the society that we live in and in the thread in the fabric of this country, women are less than and oftentimes subjugated and invalidated by structurally our society, right? Like we're treated as less than. So knowing that contextually that we have been in this country cooperating as men and women and we still see women treated less than, that to me means we're not shifting. Apology isn't going to shift. Mm-hmm. That's not our tipping point. That's not what's going to change the way that we see women. And so for me, that's just one more way that we need to be engaged in the dialogue of, yes, it should be that men are apologizing so we're equally being humane and respectful of people, because that's what apologies really are, is you're lending your respect for people's time and what have you. So we're not there, so we have to struggle with why we're not there, which the apology for me is a gateway to a larger conversation with parents of young boys. To ask, are you seeing your young boys do that? I'm always interested in when do girls and boys change? Yeah. And what are we doing environmentally to create the change? Because what I can say from myself and my own life and friends, girls and boys are very similar. And something happens when they begin to be socialized in larger settings that you really start to see the divide between girls and boys. And there are lots of things. I mean, we create binaries for everything. Girls get pink, boys get blue. Girls can cry, boys can't. I mean, we decide those things before the children are even born. And so it is going to take all of us to call out those things that seem very simple to really say that this is a building the context, the social injustices for girls.
Reinforcing it. So you obviously have been very intentional, you and your husband, very intentional about how you raise your daughter, mm-hmm. very mindful. Has she done things that surprise you that have sort of played to type in spite of your best efforts?
100%, yes. She loves pink. She's completely a princess, which I'm fine with as long as it's her choice because it's what she likes.
How many times have you seen Frozen?
Too many. Okay. And the song. I'm like every parent on Facebook, like, okay, we're over that. But I'm okay with that as long as she's making the choice. And so she's 8. So I remind her, do you really like this? Why do you like it? And then, of course, I ask her, quick questions like, so if it was the boy, what do you think? And, and the first time she said, well, Mom, it wasn't the boy. And I said, well, what if it was the boy? And she's like, well, if it was the boy, then it would be different. Mm. And she described exactly what societal we would say. The boys would have been strong. He would have made some different decisions. He wouldn't have let his sister, if it was a sister or a brother, kind of dictate their future. She didn't have that language, but that's what she said to me. And I said to her, why? And she said, well, Mom, you always tell me that, society treats boys different.
There you go.
Well, those are my words.
So she's making it. She's pulling it together herself and kind of struggling with these parallels.
She's struggling with the parallels as an 8-year-old. Absolutely.
Fantastic. So now you have a job after that. You left Scotland County Rape Crisis Center. You started working at the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You're now executive director. Tell us about that organization, what you do.
So it's a statewide organization that has a membership base that includes rape crisis centers, which North Carolina has a rape crisis center that provides direct services in all 100 counties. We also have law enforcement, attorneys, sexual assault nurse examiners, college campuses, and individuals who are members. Our primary focus is education, advocacy, and public policy work. So we provide training statewide for those ally professionals who are direct responders. But we also have a huge prevention focus and really looking at changing social norms, which has a social justice lens, to really look at how do we change the culture to responding to women, girls, and boys who are impacted by sexual violence and preventing first-time perpetration, which we believe is a cultural shift.
How has all of that work changed? You've been at this for 15 years in one way or another. How has all that work changed in those 15 years?
So I keep saying the plus and the minus is sexual assault is in the media daily. The plus is it has taken my entire career for us to have sexual assault in the media. The challenge with that is people are talking about it in a way that's disassociated from them personally. So it's kind of objectified, like this thing happens in military, it happens on college campuses, it happens in prisons, but not necessarily, which is important, and all of those things are true. Institutionals are absolutely places where sexual violence is rampant, but it's also rampant in our personal lives. And so for me, in order to see the culture change that's needed, requires individuals to see themselves in the role of change in society.
And in some ways victimized by it one way or the other. I keep looking at this word crisis in Rape Crisis Center, and I know rape crisis centers are in the area of where we're 3 decades in now in terms of the creation. Can you imagine a crisis in America going on? Can you imagine a terrorist crisis going on for 30 years and not being addressed in a more direct way?
I can't. I wrote an article about 8 years ago that said, the real terror in this country is sexual violence. Women, especially in children, have been sexually violated since the beginning of time. I mean, it for folks in the South, I say it's a biblical reference to sexual violence. Like, this is something that we know has always existed, yet we continue to ignore it. We can look at every aspect of a person who's been sexually violated life and see the impact that it has on their work, their child rearing, their careers. Their sense of self, their sense of autonomy is impacted. The trauma is something they carry lifelong. Yet we as a country has still chosen to ignore it or isolate it in such a way that it is the Rape Crisis Center's role only. And so for me, looking at this institutional response to sexual violence in military campuses, prisons is for me the door opening to say, so this is true. This is what we need to do. But how do we also make sure that society is engaged and doesn't see this as a personal isolated incident?
Well, and how prevalent is it?
I live and breathe by the 1 in 4 statistic in this country. North Carolina did its own research a couple of years ago through a statewide surveillance research and said that it was 1 in 5 in North Carolina, which, again, pretty close to the 1 in 4 in this country. And so when you use that statistic, people question the prevalence. And I always say, you probably know a survivor in your small circle of 1 in 5 people. Whether they are going to disclose also speaks to who you are and how you talk about things. So I remind people that their language is often indicative of where they stand and how they believe survivors. Sexual assault survivors are constantly re-victimized by their peers, their community, and society as a whole. And so just like the person who led me on this journey in 1993 chose to tell a small group of us and not deal with it again.
For sexual assault to be that prevalent, there have to be things built into the structure for it to continue like this. There's no way on earth. And you can imagine if this had been done, if 1 in 4 Americans were hurt by a foreign power or a foreign agent, we would spend trillions of dollars, right, trying to amend it. And we know that it's only a few decades ago that rape was not even possible for a husband, right? Husband
That's
and wife.
Right.
So it wasn't even possible. So what other kind of institutional structural reinforcements are there that we don't even see?
Several things. I mean, just the language that we use in institutional still reinforce kind of this, we're not going to deal with sexual violence. So using very strict terms that are legal, like rape, and say rape has a very direct legal connotation because it's written in our state statute. So using language like that often, of course, removes people to identify because it's by force with use of a weapon. Those are things that you could have never saw the statute. People have that right here in their heads. And so given that, it often allows people to disassociate, whether it's the survivor themselves who don't see themselves, because that's how it's defined by an institution, because it is. But also the way that when we look at young people, and we can use, you know, churches or even the Penn State case, where young survivors are often groomed by the person who violates them. And so very early on, before the first inappropriate touch occurs, the emotional and mental and psychological abuse takes place. And so really changing the way that the survivor would respond had you just inflicted the incident or, you know, the actual physical violence, the sexual violating them. But it's all the emotional pieces that are built in. And that's what we see in all of our structural institutions, is it doesn't speak to the grooming, is the word that we use, or the buildup to actually sexually violating victims.
Is there a practical way to sort of get at that, to identify it and prevent it?
So a couple of things that we're doing is changing the way that institutions define sex. So one, removing the word rape as the way they define it, which is the state definition, but really using words like sexual assault and sexual violence and using unwanted contact that can be physical, emotional, or psychological. Like just changing language that people can readily find on their own allows, one, survivors to identify, but also allowing folks who may be considering grooming to notice that, wait, we're actually changing the way that we look at this as a society. I think that's a huge first step that we actually haven't really made in this country.
So obviously, if you're about to steal a car, you know you're going to commit a felony. But
that's
you're
right.
saying the way we've structured the language, you might not know that you're about to commit a crime if you're engaged in this psychological grooming.
Especially when we're talking about people that know each other, and especially if we're talking about young people that know each other.
Yeah. So now you mentioned the military as well as one of the institutions. We'll talk about colleges and universities. What do you think about? Has the military response, do you think, changed? Is it changing?
The military response is drastically changing. One of the comments I made is several Christmases ago, I spent time going through a thousands page of the National Defense Authorization Act to find where we were actually talking about what the military's response would be to sexual assault. And so we've made huge strides. There's been clearly direct legislation and language around how militaries will respond, how they will also be working towards prevention, which is extremely important to us. And so all military installations have sexual assault victim advocates. They are now being asked to set up memorandums of understandings with rape crisis centers so that survivors on a military installation has the support on base, but also they have support off. They also have what we call unrestricted and restricted reporting, meaning they have the option to report up their chain of command or not, to not give their name so that they can still seek services. And there were also training on prevention of all military from commanders down to those entering the military for the first time.
And you weren't just reading those several thousand pages for the heck of it. Actually, you helped write a portion of the Federal Violence Against Women Act, didn't you?
Yes, and I always give credit to the hundreds of people who were on millions of conference calls to really talk about what we needed to be doing for the second reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. So the first, I was actually just graduating from high school going to college. But the subsequent Violence Against Women Act, I've had the distinct pleasure to work with colleagues across the country to really fill in the gaps and to change the language. So we've included things like looking at what our work looks like with the military, what our work looks like with campuses and universities, and now prisons. And so that's been a unique place for me to be in, to really be able to use my boots on the ground work, but also to be informed by colleagues across the country to write that language.
I am talking today with Monika Johnson-Hostler on the state of things. She's executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And we talked about language and what an important part that plays in shaping our understanding. And I think this North Carolina is, in fact, one of the first states to pass protection against sexual assault and stalking, which hadn't been part of that
through
earlier.
A protective order. Yes, yeah. I was extremely excited when we initially wrote that language. Most people know that there's a 50B or domestic violence protective order that does not lend itself to sexual assault or stalking.
Tell us how that works.
So the protective order, most people know, is they call it a piece of paper, but a victim who is a victim of sexual misconduct or stalking, as we have it defined in statute, are able to go to either their magistrate or the court's clerk of court to actually file for a protective order, which says how far, people like to talk about the distance that the perpetrator has to stay away from you. We did that because it allows victims who don't want to go through the criminal justice system to actually have some supports in place that has enforcement by law enforcement to protect them. Because again, we're talking about perpetrators who are known to them. And we also look at lethality around stalking. It's a crime that's not often talked about, but we see stalking take place in the context of relationships and out of the context. But those are it's one of the most lethal crimes for survivors of stalking.
I think the point, an important point to make, is it doesn't just prohibit the individual from getting close, but it allows you to break a lease. If that's the place where you live
that's
and
right.
you keep going home there, that's kind of a problem. Can I break the lease? And
absolutely.
The law allows that.
So one of the things we also did was change North Carolina state law to allow a victim who may not have reported to local law enforcement but has a protective order in place to break their lease so that they can move away. The perpetrator doesn't know where they live. And in some cases, it really is a level of comfort to not be in the same place that you've been associated with the perpetrator.
What about colleges and universities? Certainly, they are in the news, as you pointed out. We're finally becoming aware of the level of sexual violence on college campuses.
So given that's where my work has started, it really does feel full circle in the last year. College campuses across the country have now been identified for either Title IX violations or Clery Act violations, both requiring college campuses to provide information if you're sexually assaulted, but also to provide training for students and now for faculty and staff on the issues of sexual violence. So that's now been published. The White House has really intervened in, I think, the way appropriate, as you mentioned earlier. If there was any other form of violence happening in this country, there would be a top-down response. And this is the first time that we've had actually a top-down response from this administration. And they've created a document and a task force that really speaks to defining sexual violence and all the ways that it occurs, but also how you can seek help and how we're going to hold accountable colleges and universities.
One of the complications, we talked about college campuses and the military, is that you have these two jurisdictions and it's hard to know where to report and whether the community at large is the appropriate place. Are we getting any more clarity on that?
We are. The language in both statutes, both military and now campus and universities, which was actually a part of the Violence Against Women Act, the Campus Save Act, that it really talks about, and I am realizing that most people didn't know that you could actually make a report on college campus. And so making sure that college campuses have processes in place to deal with the reports once it happens, but also survivors do still have their right to actually seek outside community-based criminal justice response as well.
Today on The State of Things, talking to Monika Johnson-Hostler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of the Wake County School Board. We'll talk more about that when our program continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking today with Monika Johnson-Hostler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of the Wake County School Board. Wake County, of course, the largest school district in the state of North Carolina. And you decided to run for office this last time around. Tell us about that decision.
So I was enrolling my daughter back to my 8-year-old into school, and my husband and I were, of course, having lots of conversations about how complicated it was, how cumbersome it was, and I was making lots of complaints about parents who may not have the same capacity to actually go through this process to make really good decisions for their children or the time and opportunity to visit all these schools. And it'd been going on for a couple of weeks, maybe even longer. I'm a really good thinker out loud, so I've probably been complaining longer than a month. but on the way to school one morning, my daughter says to me, "Mommy, I have a question." And that's like, everybody knows that's so like the cue up for something big coming, because she still says that. And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Why do you keep complaining about the school?" And I said, "Well, because I have a lot of issues." And she said, "Well, you know, you told me when I did my project on Rosa Parks that if there is a problem, that it is our job to be the solution. So are you the solution or are you the problem?" And I tried to divert the conversation. That didn't happen. And she still wanted to know. She was like, "So are you going to be the school board?" And I said, "Well, that's not really how that works. You have to run." And so I'm trying to explain, you know, civic engagement and democracy. Mm-hmm. And she says, "So are you going to do it?"
You right did back this to yourself,
point.
Right?
Yeah. Right, okay. Back to the point. And I said, "I don't know." And I didn't talk about it again. And I finally had some colleagues really start to hammer me about if I'd be interested. People know I'm extremely interested in politics. And I initially said no. And I went home and talked to my husband. And he said, "Well, you know, you actually had this conversation with our daughter a year ago." So it literally came back to that conversation. And that's how I made the decision.
And your husband's a teacher.
He is a teacher.
System.
So, he's a high school math teacher.
And so this stuff is swirling all around you, and finally your daughter, it all comes back to haunt you.
Yes, it does.
Whatever we
all
say
all the
to
things
them.
We teach them.
What were the things that you were complaining about? What were the tops on your agenda?
The tops on my agenda was how complicated the system was just to navigate the online system. Mm. The fact that I grew up in a small town, you had a few options of schools, it was easy for people to make a decision. Now, I was visiting schools and the schools were so vastly different in what they offered, what the makeup was. And so the difference for me, I'm married to a teacher, so it wasn't about numbers for us. It really was about the feel of the school environment and what that would mean for our child. So my real complaint was what type of parents don't have that opportunity? I live my life focused on social justice and injustices. And so for me, that rose to the top for me, is not every family will have the opportunity that I had to visit 10 schools.
That's
and spend time at 10 schools. So that was my number one. And the second thing is, I didn't understand the school system. And I thought, gosh, there are 4 degrees in my house alone. How can we not understand, you know, how to make the right decision for our daughter? We're reading online. We don't know if we click this button and choose a school, does it mean we opt out of other schools? Just the language itself at the time wasn't friendly to me as a consumer. And so that was the second thing that I was making a lot of complaints about, is it wasn't friendly to consumers.
And one of the interesting things, I mean, I think it got that way in because in large part this school system had become a model school system for its diversity plan, but it meant it was very intentional and therefore complicated, and it broke down, as we know briefly, but it was still at one point the model nationally. So there you go again. In order to fix the system, you have to sort of create these new complexities, right?
That's right. And that's where I am today.
You did that. So you're working on, so have you fixed it yet? Is your daughter on you? She wants you to fix it, right?
So she did ask me if I fixed it. And I did tell her that there are over 150,000 moving parts, because that's how many children are in the school system, which means there are families attached to those. There's bus routes attached to those. Right. So I've been very honest with her that mommy has to do a lot of work to even really decide at what place she wants to start to really fix the system. I am also very clear that we have a school board, a superintendent who are absolutely committed to moving Wake County back to a model school system, and taking the time that it takes to get there is what I think is important that people hear is, no, we don't have an answer today.
All right. I'll have you back next week then. you've done now, interestingly enough, during your campaign, you also ran into a few things that were overt racism as you're running for a school board.
Absolutely. So, I mean, clearly there's no surprise to people. I've lived in this body, almost 40 years as a black woman. So I know that. I'm very aware of that. And I also have done a lot of work around dispelling racism and also what internalized oppression looks like. And so in the campaign, I had not really anticipated that's what I would run into, not overt. We're far more subtle and sophisticated for that. But I ran into real clear racism. And what I'll say is, we talked about the complexities. It felt like overt racism to me. The person who delivered it, I do not think meant to be racist. The comment was made to me, well, once they decided that I was, a reputable candidate to run, the next thing they said was, so you're not going to put your picture on it, because then people will know that you're African-American. Because you can actually use your name and people won't know.
Wow.
I was completely taken aback. But
you can see how that might have been meant well.
I absolutely, right? Absolutely, I do. And that's why I still believe that the person who said that to me did not say that to me to intentionally be racist. But what I couldn't do in that moment, which is rare for me, is explain to that person why that was offensive to me, which when I say rare, I mean rare. I'm not at a loss of words, but I was. Yeah, I was absolutely, because I cognitively knew that it wasn't racist, but it still hurt and stung like racism to me. And the first thing I thought is, I have a daughter who's excited about this, who is going to be engaged in, should I be considering my race as a primary factor in how I run this campaign? So that's why it felt racist to me, because it was the first time I thought my race is absolutely has to be on the forefront of my own agenda in running this campaign, which is not what my intentions were.
Did you talk to your daughter about that?
Well, I talked to my husband, and because I have a daughter who inserts herself very well, she didn't hear the whole conversation, but she did say, and she's intuitive, and she said, Mommy, are your feelings hurt? And I said, yes. And she said, did somebody hurt them? And I said, yes. And I did take the time to say to her that people often hurt your feelings unintentionally, and said to her, if somebody says something to you at school that you felt hurt your feelings, what do you do? And she said, well, I say to them, it hurts my feelings. And I said, have you ever had somebody say, I didn't mean to? And she said, well, all the time. And so I explained to her that that's what had happened to Mommy, is that I don't think that person intentionally was trying to hurt my feelings. And she said, about what? And I told her it was about race.
Wow. So this brings us, I think, to another topic and probably a challenge for any school board member. These complexities, when we talked about the school-to-prison pipeline, this is a phrase that is widely used. I don't know how well understood it is, but there would certainly be those who would say, we're not sending our children, particularly children of color, to prison by the school system. And you all want the complexity, because nobody hires a racist teacher, right? I mean, you don't go looking for them. And if you're a teacher, you don't intend to be that way. And yet, when you look at the statistics, something is wrong.
Something is wrong.
How do you explain that? And how do you get the attention of people, particularly on the board or in the public, to at least pay attention to the statistics and ask, is there something wrong here?
I think we have a school board who's paying attention. So luckily, I don't have to work to convince them of that. I do think we are going to have to work to get our county and community members to be engaged in the complexity of this dialogue. That no, we are not saying teachers individually or principals are sending students to prison. especially mostly African-American boys, and girls are those, their numbers are increasing as well. We do have to have the discussion about kids who are displaced as early as third grade by virtue of their race and oftentimes their socioeconomic class.
When you say displaced, be clear about that. What do you mean?
Where so when I displaced? Say displaced, I mean that we have very few, especially kids of color. We were primarily talking about African-American, but statistics are just as high now for Latino kids as well. So when I say that, I really am talking about both African-American and Latino kids, because that's where we're seeing the real disparity for our children. And I mean that as early as third grade, when we see academically gifted placement, we are seeing, well, starting back when I was in school, we were not seeing kids of color really placed there. And 40 years later, we're still talking about the same thing, that in third grade, we have fewer kids of color being placed into academically gifted programs. I don't think anybody believes that your race can determine solely whether you're smart or not. So if we all know that, then why are we all okay with a small number of our students that are kids of color being placed? Now, Wake County has put lots of things in place. Like, we've increased the type of testing that we're giving kids. We're looking at tests like the Ohio test that actually test different learning styles. So that's one step that the county has made. But that's new and that's innovative. And I can't take credit for that. They were looking at that before I came on the school board, but we are going to have to continue to be innovative to start looking at what we're doing as early as third grade with kids of color.
And we've seen the research. There's research that's done right over here at Duke that shows that retested some kids, and it's very clear that kids were misplaced. In fact, in many cases, they should have been in GT, gifted and talented, and were in LD, learning disabled classes. And the evidence is very clear, the academic evidence, that a lot of this is going on. And we also see evidence we saw in Wake County several years ago when they did a look at kids who were being suspended, that 60% of African-Americans were males.
Yes.
Over 60% were suspended for first-time use of cell phones. First-time use of cell phone for white male, 21% suspension. The correlation between suspension and criminal justice is lockstep. And so those are the kinds of statistics we're talking about. We're not going to the holding centers. We're starting in third grade and
right.
Eighth grade.
And I think for me, that's what's most important, is to remind people that when we say school to prison pipeline, we're really talking about a structural long-term process that we can see as early as third grade. And we're not talking about ninth graders who got in trouble 9th, 10th grade, and now they have a detention officer because whatever happened at school. So they had a cell phone use. And I always like to give people those examples. So first offense, they go home for short-term suspension for cell phone use. Second offense, they get into a fight at school, they're suspended long-term. So we now have one kid who's been out of school at least 13 to 15 days. That's a lot for one kid out of school. And given we know how much more rigorous student learning and the need for them to be in the classroom is today than it ever before. So that's where I'm trying to get people to start right there, to realize if you just start with the number of days they're out of school, two things have happened. They've missed instructional time. And guess what? They are, in most cases, unattended young people at home with nothing to do.
As just a very practical matter, being out of school is a bad thing, and it correlates. But also, if you are a person of color, if you're African American, you're paying attention to who's getting suspended and who's not. You're beginning to see it and feel it in ways that the teacher who didn't intend it, that the principal who didn't intend it, and perhaps the white students who just see a kid getting suspended for a cell phone didn't feel it. You're feeling it in a different way because you're paying attention to who's getting suspension.
That's right.
And who's not.
And I'm glad the data's there, because without the data and the academic support, it makes it very difficult for folks to at this point say they're not going to support the school system in really addressing the inequalities.
One of the things you've noticed, I understand, as a member of the school board, is how, and because it's so complex, that people mistake school board policy for what might be school building implementation of a policy, right?
Absolutely. So I'm a policy person by design. I work on a lot of federal policy. And so I had a clear understanding, and I think the example I often use is my husband and I, who have a lot of table conversation about our work world. And so school is no different. And so what's been most interesting about the transition to me being on the school board is, you know, he comes home and says, hey, this is what we're doing in our PLT, professional learning team. And I say, oh, that's great. This is how it relates to policy 6600. And he says, how is that and why? So really seeing the real distinction between policy at the top level and implementation at the school level. And for me, the reality has been, and I've been saying, you know, to the school system, and they've been very open to it, is we then have to explain that to parents. We then have to let them know that the school board is setting a policy. The implementation then goes to the school building, which, yes, there's variations because there's a thing called letter of the law and spirit of the law. And that is true for policy and really helping parents and students understand those distinctions.
Well, and it's a kind of policy governance relationship where you set broad parameters and then allow the executives to execute the policy and kind of understand that. So Wake County, like a lot of the larger counties in this state, are struggling with how to pay teachers fairly owing to the fact that their wages have been frozen for so long. Taxes have been cut, making it harder for them to get the money that they feel they deserve. And if we didn't think they deserved it, we can just look at the exodus as a kind of market answer to whether they want to be here or not. What's Wake County going to do? What do you want to do on the Wake County School Board if the state doesn't do enough?
So I think you all know that we have really been proactive in passing our own school budget that was very clear in our request to Wake County commissioners on what we thought was fair, not just for our school teachers, but everybody in that school building. I think that's important for people to know that we believe teachers are absolutely instrumental in our workforce, but we also know that it takes everyone in that building to make sure our kids are getting what they need throughout the day. And so we were very deliberate in our budget. We talked about clear pay for teachers and support staff, but we also talked about looking at business cases for very specific things to look at implementation. So how do we use a business case to project high needs? Do we need differentiated pay to really ensure that our high need schools are getting what they need? And really being clear that a lot of this is going to take a learning process for us so we can implement what research says and then look at how it is applicable to the school system. But we did that through our budget and we were very thoughtful and we had great leadership from our superintendent on getting us there. So we've made our message clear and now we're just beating the drum to county commissioners and hoping that our citizens will join us in saying this is important. This budget really sets the tone for how important we think our teachers are.
How do you feel about Common Core standards?
So I'm a fan of Common Core, and I get that I am one of few. And I always like to give the disclaimer as to why. It is not how I learned, but I do believe that as a parent, my goal is for my daughter to be better and smarter than me. Not today, but like
Monica,
probably next week.
I'm getting the feeling that maybe...
I think she's there. My girlfriend said I probably should not play Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader with my fourth grader, which I think is true. But I think the rigor is invaluable. We are raising a generation that has to be competitive. There was not a thought in my mind in 1993 when I graduated from high school that I was going to be competitive with people in other countries. It just wasn't here for me. It is there for our kids who are in middle school already. They already know that competition isn't just their peers in that classroom, but it's global. And so for us to not pay attention to ways that we can make our kids competitive and compare apples to apples in this country, which is what I think we've never done before, and Common Core does that. So what we call it, I'm indifferent to. The rigor and the structure of Common Core and the standards are what are important to me. I'm also, again, I love policy. Common Core speaks to helping our students understand what they learn in the class, how it is applicable to everyday current events. That's something that is invaluable to me, is that our third graders are reading the paper and learning farm to table means what to them. They can learn how to measure. They can learn the importance of our environment. So I think if people break it down in those small chunks, they can understand why I'm a fan of Common Core.
Monica, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Monica Johnson-Hosler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of the Wake County School Board. You can find out more about her and those organizations at our website, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Our intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.